Here's a passage from one of Henry James's short stories called The Private Life. It's about an actress whom James calls Blanche Adney. It's the kind of passage that I think our students, or many of them, would now have some problems in reading. I'll read it. It is difficult to be cursory over this charming woman who was beautiful without beauty and complete with a dozen deficiencies. The perspective of the stage made her over, and in society she was like the model off the pedestal. She was a picture walking about, which to the artless social mind was a perpetual surprise, a miracle. People thought she told them secrets of the pictorial nature, in return for which they gave her relaxation and tea. She told them nothing, and she drank the tea. But they had, all the same, the best of the bargain.
Literary scholar Dennis Donahue. He's here to talk about reading and American education. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. When we talk about education these days, the conversation often turns to the increasing technical sophistication of our classrooms. But according to one of our most distinguished literary scholars, the fundamental skills of reading have never been more important. Dennis Donahue holds the Henry James Chair of English and American Letters at New York University, where he also serves as university professor. In addition to his teaching and literary scholarship, Dennis Donahue is currently a member of a study group established by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation to examine the future of humanities education in the United States. He says that reading is much more than a fundamental academic exercise. It is, in fact, one of the key factors at work in the development of our students' moral imagination. Dennis Donahue is the author of a recent biography of the Victorian writer Walter Pater and a collection of essays on literature entitled The Old Moderns. Dennis Donahue, welcome back to Soundings. How are you, sir?
Thank you very much indeed. It's good to be back.
Let's begin with this. What is the biographer of Walter Pater doing writing a book about reading?
Well, it is a bit of a new development, a change of pace and I hope perhaps a change of style. It's not that there was anything in the biography of Pater which raised any particular question about reading, except perhaps in a general way. But for the past few years, I've been a bit preoccupied with the question of reading, and partly because of my conviction, which has been growing over the years, that we as teachers are failing to teach our students, really, what reading entails.
Now, that sounds like such an innocent word. It is such a commonplace in education. We go to school to read and write and do arithmetic and all of that. What kind of reading are you talking about?
Well, I think there are two kinds of reading. Indeed, one of them is called extensive reading, and the other is intensive reading. And extensive reading is pretty well the way we all read the newspapers, or for the most part. We flick. We read quickly. It's speed reading, if you like. We read a lot of stuff, but we only hover occasionally on, you know, something we want to pay attention to. But the kind of reading that we want to teach in schools, and colleges, and universities is intensive reading. That is slow, dense, as it were, patient reading. It's a reading that is adequate to the materials we're reading, and that is, of course, for the most part, it's literature.
Now, are we looking for bad guys and villains here, or are we talking about the exercise itself, what needs to be taught rather than clearing our way through the thicket of distractions?
No, this would apply. There are no bad guys, at least I'm not one of them anyway, but I don't think there are any. Anyway, no, it's not a question of what we read, it's a question of how we read. And I'm not saying that we would read a Shakespeare play in exactly the same way as we read the newspaper, of course not.
Right.
But one of the attributes of major literature is that it demands to be read. You cannot, as it were, just read it at a bus stop or in the subway. So that it does involve, to an extraordinary degree, it involves a commitment to the language, a commitment to the detail, to the syntax, to the grammar, to the reverberations of the language, to the way in which language seems to be present in the literature.
It also goes to the human imagination. It goes to our ability to the way we process all of this that we're taking in. On the right track?
That's crucial. The act of the imagination is crucial because, after all, the whole, in my view, the real function of literature and the real reason for reading it is that literature provokes us or enables us, impels us to try to imagine what it would be like to be different, what it would be like to have a different life.
Right.
And indeed, the whole basis of sympathy is imagination. If we can't imagine what it would be like to be someone else, there is now no good reason why we should sympathize with that person.
Dennis, let's come back to that example that we heard you read at the very beginning of Soundings this week. This is a brief passage from Henry James. Unpack this for me, and I'll ask you to read it again.
Well, if you take the very first sentence, it is difficult to be cursory over this charming woman, who was beautiful without beauty, and complete with a dozen deficiencies. Mm-hmm. Now, I believe that I could place that sentence before many of my students, and I think they would have extreme difficulties with it. They would wonder, for example, about what it means to say that she was beautiful without beauty. How are you beautiful without beauty?
Mm-hmm.
How could she be complete with a dozen deficiencies? And indeed, I think if we asked our students simply to write a page of commentary on the phrase beautiful without beauty and another page on the word complete or complete with a dozen deficiencies, I think they'd be pretty, or many of them would be pretty well stumped. But if you think of the phrase who was beautiful without beauty, now fairly clearly James is invoking here the notion of a discrepancy between appearance and reality.
Mm-hmm.
She was beautiful in the sense that she presented an appearance of beauty without the possession of beauty, which fairly clearly James is invoking here as a kind of moral category or a depth category. So that rather like an actress, and this is pretty well the way he thought of actresses, she could present herself as entrancing and as beautiful and charming and so on. But these could indeed be matters of appearance rather than reality.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also then picking up that particular ambivalence of beautiful without beauty, and he's repeating it or repeating the form of it by saying, and complete with a dozen deficiencies. Now, if she's complete with a dozen deficiencies, that completeness means a completeness of appearance. It's a visual completeness. It's a completeness of presentation. And the fact that it goes along with a dozen deficiencies doesn't undermine the completeness of the presentation.
Well, now here we're back to complexity. We're also back to the demands that you as a teacher are placing upon the shoulders of your students. That is to say, to wrestle with language, not simply use it in the most practical, pragmatic sense when they go through their educations, whether it is a small passage from Henry James or indeed the enterprise of reading, which they bring to college.
All I'm asking of my students is to be patient,
mm-hmm.
To bear in mind that they're in university for 3 or 4 or more years, and that this is, in a sense, time out. And perhaps for many of them, it's the only time out they're ever going to have.
Right.
But it is time out to read, to think, to feel, to enjoy. So that if I ask students to read slowly and patiently, and not, for example, to take that passage from Henry James at a gallop, I think it's perfectly reasonable to do that during these few years.
Well, now, what about the argument that apart from the moral, psychological issues that James may or may not be raising in a passage like that, let me be contentious with you, Dennis. Are you teaching art here for the sake of art? That is to say, apart from our, again, moral involvement in the world that we inhabit and its connection to literature?
That's, of course, a very contentious phrase, and I'm deeply shocked that you should present it in those terms. In fact, if by art for art's sake we mean a deep concern with the formal and aesthetic aspects of a work of art, then yes, I am all for art for art's sake, because the alternative in practice to art for art's sake is the gross politicization of art and literature from which we're suffering at the moment.
Speaking of explosive words, politics and literature, how in the world do we bring them together or keep them apart?
Well, it seems to me at the moment far more urgent to distinguish them. Of course they can't be kept apart, if only because we use language. I mean, the very same words, by and large, the same words that T.S. Eliot uses in his poems are words that you and I, for the most part, could use in conversation. We
mm-hmm.
would use them differently. And in reading Eliot's poems, I would be concerned to see the difference. So that what I certainly try to teach our students is not to, as it were, not to allow the work of literature to capitulate before the shall we say, the general oppressiveness of the world, whether that oppressiveness takes a political, religious, economic, or any other form. It seems to me that the first thing a teacher of literature ought to do is to believe that literature exists.
By itself.
And that's by no means as self-evident. You know, when we say literature exists, that means it is there and it has relations with everything else. But these relations are such that literature should not, in fact, capitulate to everything else. Literature has just as much a right to exist as economics or religion or piety or anything else.
Fair enough. One of the charges that the critics bring, Dennis Donahue, is that literature does things to corrupt the young. And in fact, you told me the other night that you had just finished writing a review of, three contemporary British or Irish novelists, and you blushed. You had never used so many four-letter words sitting there at your word processor. How do we come to this? Are we talking about art? Are we talking about free speech? Are we talking about education? Bring them together for me.
Well, I think we should make it clear that in typing out the four-letter words, I was quoting from the novels. I wasn't using these from my own voice.
Thank you. Very fair enough.
But I should also emphasize, though, that what we're doing again, suppose one of those novels was a novel by the Scottish writer James Kelman. And he is asking us, through that language, vulgar and demotic as it is, mm-hmm. he is asking us to imagine the character whom he calls Sammy. Now, the act of imagining such a character, I would say, is a morally crucial act, the act to be able to imagine such a character.
It's also a morally repugnant act for some readers. So that is to say, the fact that I'm even reading this somehow or other sullies me. It does something bad to me rather than opens my imagination.
No, I don't agree with that at all. I mean, if you go to see, say, a play like Macbeth, you're not in any way impelled to commit murder. You imagine what it is like for Macbeth to be driven, or to drive himself, or to be driven by his wife to commit murder. But you do not in any way. There is a distance. There is an aesthetic distance between the act as it is mimed on the stage mm-hmm. and the act as it is done in, shall we say, in the world.
Well, you make me think of Mark Twain, who was accused of being a racist because of language that he used. The charge is, again, a very old one. How do you come to grips with it in the classroom? I mean, you write your books, Dennis, and you have the articles and the conferences. But when you're there with those young and tender minds, what do you say to them?
I say, exert your imagination and know what you're doing by doing so. Mm-hmm. You don't have, if you read, for example, a case in point is W.B. Yeats's poem, Leda and the Swan. Now, that is one of the classical myths about the rape of Leda by the god Zeus in the form of a swan, from which certain catastrophic consequences ensue. Now, that, in fact, is, in my view, a very great poem. It's a very remarkable, very powerful poem.
It's the power of the art, not the subject.
It's a very powerful work of art. And, of course, to read this poem is not in any way to be impelled to go out and commit a rape. Not at all. Because to read it, and, of course, this comes back to my theme of good reading, one is reading very badly. If one feels impelled by Yeats's poem to go out and to rape someone, one mm-hmm. is reading very badly. One is hardly reading at all. That is, one is not reading with a view to the language, the form, the move, the trajectory of the phrases, the impingement of one phrase upon another. Did she put on his knowledge with his power before the indifferent beak could let her drop? Mm. Now, The way to read that is not say, well, yes, she probably did, or maybe she did, or maybe she didn't.
Or she should go out and form a support group.
Or go out and form a support group. The way to read that is to engage with the movement of the words. Uh-huh. It's to allow the words to have their full impact within the rhythm of the question. And within the context of the poem as a whole.
You live, as it were, in a relatively rarefied atmosphere. You teach at NYU. You hold the Henry James Chair of English and American Letters there. In a way, that's separate from what goes on in American classrooms. And yet, how do we bring this compelling argument that you were making about what and how kids should read, not what so much as how? How do you get it into the general mainstream?
Well, firstly, of course, course, when there's nothing at all rarefied about the atmosphere in which I teach. I teach in a big metropolitan university. I teach graduate students. I also teach undergraduate students. So I teach freshmen who are just from high school. And many of the problems that I'm engaged in as a teacher are problems that arise both from the merits and also from the defects of the high school teaching. So that there's nothing at all ethereal or rarefied about those situations. I don't know enough because I didn't grow up in America and I never went to an American school or college. So I speak to some extent as a foreigner, if not indeed as a tourist, although I've been here for 15 years. But I don't know enough about the inside of classrooms to pronounce on a thing like this. That is, I see only the results of the classroom. I see and I'm in contact with the boys and girls as they come into their freshman classes. But at that stage, I do think, not so much that a lot of damage has been done, but rather that a lot of opportunities have been missed. It's very, very few students, in fact, who are good readers, as I would regard good reading at that point.
Would you say, Dennis, is this a question of intelligence and native ability? We have a lot of talk in this country about race and intelligence, for example. Are we talking about the devices of education, or are we talking about the minds that these young people bring to the enterprise?
No, I don't think it has anything at all to do with... I mean, the question of intelligence is a separate issue. That's not what it's about at all. There is, I think, a very bad and indeed an increasingly bad tradition developing. That is the notion that somehow reading should involve the swift conversion of whatever one reads into a matter of discourse. Now, my view is that the slower the teaching, the slower the reading is, the better. Because it seems to me that the worst possible way of reading is to read so that one's prejudices will be ratified. And a great deal of what goes on under the heading of reading in colleges and universities indeed takes that form. Mm-hmm. Many, many thousands of students are reading simply to have their prejudices confirmed, prejudices which we encourage them to believe are value judgments, which of course they're not.
I don't want to take you too far afield here, Dennis Donahue, but do I hear the word television hovering here? That is to say, the relationship of what our students are as students to the wider world of popular culture and entertainment?
Television imposes a kind of tempo. It imposes a meretricious speed upon our reading.
This would never, of course, happen on the radio.
Well, it wouldn't happen on the radio quite as easily. That's true.
Right.
But I think we're both prejudiced in favor of radio. That's certainly true. But I think many of our students read, shall we say, in ways that are compatible with and that ultimately issue from the ways in which they watch television.
Mm-hmm.
That is, they can flick a glance or they can return to it or go back or have a cup of coffee or something like that. But the notion of a deep patient engrossment with the object of attention, really, reading is a matter of paying attention. That's what we're asking. That's what we're asking students to do, is to pay attention. But the very notion of paying attention is, of course, something that has to be explicated.
It sounds so simple, such a simple request or demand to make. Dennis Donahue, let's step back from the topic of reading as such. Tell me about the work that you were involved in as a member of a study commission, an advisory group that the Mellon Foundation has set up. You're looking at a very large phrase here, the future of humanities education.
Well, this arises from a conference which was held here at the National Humanities Center under the auspices of the Center and the Mellon Foundation last fall, where the Mellon Foundation and the Center invited about 15 or 16 of us, mostly philosophers, literary critics, art historians, and so on. And we were asked to try to answer two questions. Firstly, what changes had taken place in our branch of the profession during the last 20 or 25 years, which we thought most important? And secondly, did we think these changes were structural or superficial? Now, at the end of the weekend conference, I think it was pretty clear that we had no great wisdom to contribute on the second question, because we don't speak for posterity. We're not in a position to say whether a particular change is a structural or a superficial change.
Right.
But each of us tried to indicate what had been happening in his or her neck of the woods, as it were, during the past 20 years. I, of course, was obsessively worried about reading. What else? I wasn't worried about Walter Pater or T.S. Eliot at the time. But I did try to start my thoughts working on what was going wrong with teaching, the teaching of reading. So my work here at the Center has been to write a long essay, perhaps too long, developing and trying to bring forward evidence in regard to teaching. And the way I've done it, I've finished it now, the way I've done it is that I've taken the play Macbeth, and I've gone back about 60 or 70 years to see how major critics have read passages from the play Macbeth.
And how has that changed over...
Well, it has changed, I really think, radically and quite disastrously. That is the critics who were writing 60 or 70 years ago about Macbeth, they really do exhibit a deep engagement with the detail, word by word, syllable by syllable, nuance by nuance of the language. What has been happening, I think, in the last 15 years especially, is that you can see it even in the way in which critics of the present generation quote from Macbeth. They quote from the play merely to illustrate a thesis they've already put up front. They've announced the thesis. The thesis, very roughly speaking, is that the play Macbeth is Shakespeare's fantasy of self-creation and immortality removed from the necessity of women.
Mm.
And that idea, which is by no means a boring idea, but that idea is put up front. It's announced at the very beginning, and therefore passages which are then quoted are quoted merely to illustrate and to enforce this particular idea.
Well, now, let me argue with you, Dennis. What about the argument that if it's there on the page and Shakespeare used the words and he has a female character that this critic or that chooses to construe from a political, a feminist, a gender perspective, whatever happens to be new if not trendy, isn't Shakespeare malleable enough and great enough and susceptible enough to our comings and goings in literary criticism and reading to withstand that, and we'll move on to another set of readings?
Oh, I'm not at all worried about Shakespeare. Shakespeare can take care of himself. Oh, no. Shakespeare's plays are patient of interpretation.
What you're worried about is the students.
I'm worried about the students. Mm-hmm. I'm not at all troubled about Shakespeare. He will survive. I'm not sure whether our students will survive,
right.
But he will survive. No. What I'm worried about is that reading, which I've just enunciated, is a grossly and flagrantly reductive reading.
All right, now let me argue with you again, Dennis Donahue. Suppose I were to say to you, I am your student, you are my teacher. Well, now wait, you don't like me because I disagree with you. Where does the conversation go from there?
No, I like you. I love you even if you disagree with me. I don't have any problem whatsoever about disagreement.
Right.
What I have problems about in teaching, all I would ask a student to do is to articulate. But that, of course, is quite a tall order.
And that depends on a lot of close reading.
It depends on close reading and close writing. It depends upon the development of skills in articulation and skills in reading and writing.
Uh-huh.
Now, of course, one of the problems at the moment, and it is a major one in my branch of the profession, is that the profession has largely broken down into a whole series of tribes or factions. And, we give them various names. We call them Marxism, Deconstruction, Feminism, New Historicism,
mm-hmm.
Pragmatism. There are many of them. While, of course, continuously then in the background, there is old, good old-fashioned bourgeois liberalism, which is proceeding, much derided in theory and in the pedagogy of many classrooms, but
right.
Nevertheless still very largely intact and indeed an object of aspiration to millions of people. But these are what we call the paper wars, or at least, these are the culture wars. They may mm-hmm. turn out to be merely paper wars, but I don't think they will. I think it's more than paper is entailed.
What do you say to the parents? My sense is that here's an element in the equation that frequently gets left out. After all, they're the ones who are raising the kids and paying the bills. Do you have anything?
Well, I think parents should be concerned about the nature and the quality of the teaching. I've no doubt that there is in the United States, as indeed there is in all countries, I'm sure, a tremendous amount of sheer nonsense and folly goes on under the guise of teaching. There is, I'm certain, an immense amount of very bad teaching goes on all over the world. But I think parents should be able to exert pressure to ensure as far as possible.
Without becoming literary types themselves.
Well, they don't need to become literary types. I think they have to be, or they ought to be aware that for something as fundamental as reading, which after all is really it's the first act of the entire drama. I mean, nothing goes on without reading. If that's wrong, or if that's defective, then everything else is defective. I mean, if the skills involved in reading and imagination, if these skills are not taught at a relatively early age, then of course the thing is pretty well hopeless.
Dennis, a very quick footnote to our conversation. As a world-class interpreter of literature and reader of literature, tell me very quickly, what are you reading right now?
Well, I'm reading a lot of philosophy. I'm reading a good deal of French philosophy because I'm writing a piece for the New York Review of Books on the French philosopher Emmanuel Levinas, or rather I'm writing about the third draft of it, so because it's difficult. That's what I'm reading. I'm also reading, rereading Jonathan Swift because I'm going back to Ireland to give a lecture at a Swift conference called The Brainwashing of Lemuel Gulliver, in which I'll put forward a theory about how to read Gulliver's Travels.
Dennis Donahue holds the Henry James Chair of English and American Letters at New York University. His recent books include a biography of Walter Pater and a collection of essays on literature and literary theory entitled The Old Moderns, published by Alfred Knopf. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Dennis Donahue also served on a study group established by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation to examine the future of humanities education in the United States. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio cassette of this program. It's Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was literary scholar Dennis Donahue of New York University. Audio cassettes are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 792. That's $10, program number 792. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Next week on Soundings, Cityscapes. Join me for conversations about the future of the American city. You'll hear from Baltimore Mayor Kurt Schmoke, New York Times cultural critic Paul Goldberger, and historian Gary Wills of Northwestern University. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.